A few years ago, I visited Acadia National. Pay no attention to the man walking behind me. I visited Acadia National Park in Maine. Has anyone ever been there? A few, yes. It is a spectacular place. And one of the most popular sites in Acadia is Cadillac Mountain. It is the highest mountain on the entire eastern seaboard, which means that if you see the sunrise when you're standing on top of Cadillac Mountain, you are the first in the United States, the entire United States, to greet the new day. Now, I am not an early riser, am I, Lisa? That's an understatement. But one morning when I was at Acadia, I happened to wake up very early. All right, if you must know, I had to go to the bathroom, okay? And you know how it is when you're camping. By the time you get out of your sleeping bag and you put your shoes on and you put the dog's leash on because he'll bark if you leave and you stagger through the darkness to the bathrooms, by the time you do all of that, you're awake. So I decided, I'm up early. I'm going to drive up Cadillac Mountain and see the sunrise. Turns out I wasn't the only one. The parking lot was packed, as it is every morning there. People were spread out. It was a somewhat chaotic atmosphere. Parents were holding grumpy sleeping kids, and other children were running around. We all waited for the sun to rise. And if you're standing on top of a mountain cliff on the East Coast and you look east, what is it that you see? The Atlantic Ocean. That's right. And the horizon is this clean, straight line. It looks so beautiful in the early morning. As sunrise neared, the voices and the chaos, the activity of the people around me died down, and everyone just naturally fell silent. And then we saw it. Across the flat ocean, the sun made its appearance. This bright, glowing, orange circle that just took my breath away. And it rose so quickly, within a very few moments from when that orange edge became visible, the entire circle of the sun was in full view, just floating, suspended over the ocean's edge. I don't think I breathed the entire time. It was so beautiful. There's something so powerful about the sun. I felt a little bit that same way a few weeks ago during the eclipse. Lisa and I went up to TCU and got these to wear. Probably you had some version. I thought about preaching my entire sermon like this. Didn't seem like that would be a good idea. At TCU, they had these telescopes that you could look through. They had a huge screen that showed the eclipse. But the coolest thing to me, honestly, was putting on those glasses, looking right at the sun. I know some people from my congregation traveled so that they could see the full eclipse, and they say it was amazing. But honestly, the viewing here was better than I thought it would be. It was so clear and distinct. So why am I talking about the sun so much today? Well, today we continue our worship series on the evolution of God. We're telling the story of how humans have conceived of God from the very beginning until now. And in the earliest days, the sun had a lot to do with it. For example, ancient peoples encountered solar eclipse differently than we do. Imagine that you are a Plains Indian. On a perfect summer day, you're hunting buffalo under a cloudless prairie sky when suddenly, for no reason at all, the sky begins to darken. All of a sudden, it's almost like twilight that you've never seen before. You see colors and shadows that are different than they were just 5 minutes before. And then you look up and you see what appears to be a hole in the sky. How in the world would you make sense of that? Ancient peoples tried to make sense of their world, just like we do. And since they did not have the heritage of modern science to give them a head start, they reached pre-scientific conclusions. Almost universally, the sun played a major role in the earliest of what we call religion. Though it's not really religion like we think of it, the beliefs and the rituals that we label religious are just how they lived, right? I mean, if you asked a hunter-gatherer what his religion was, he wouldn't know what you're talking about. One thing he would know is that the sun is stupendous. It was the source of life itself. It was power and light and warmth. And the sun was constant and predictable. So whenever something happened to disrupt the reliability of the sun, like an eclipse, people noticed. They noticed and they assigned some kind of meaning to it. Mostly, they were terrified when the sun appeared to go away. They were afraid it wouldn't come back. Today, we're talking about primal religions. We're going to talk about two characteristics of primal religions. By the way, I included a worship or a sermon outline in your bulletins if you'd like to see that. The two characteristics we're going to talk about are, one, primal religions are highly superstitious. Obscure elements often decide life and death, war and peace. And second, primal religions are polytheistic. They include the presence of many supernatural beings or gods or spirits. Now, we see both superstition and polytheism in the Bible. We're going to look at a couple of passages, so grab a Bible nearby. Let's look first at one example in which we see raw superstition at work. Turn to, in your Bibles, 2 Kings 13. Now, when you're looking for a book like 2 Kings, the table of contents is your friend. It's okay to use it. Turn to 2 Kings in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Scriptures, and we're going to be looking at chapter 13. Whoever finds it, shout out a page number for us. 345. 2 Kings chapter 13, page 345 in the Old Testament section of your Bibles. So in this story, the prophet Elisha is preparing King Joash for battle. Look for the superstition. We'll pick up the reading in chapter 13, verse 18, kind of in the middle of the paragraph there. He is talking about Elisha. Elisha continued, "Take the arrows." And he, the king, he's talking to, and the king took them. Elisha said to the king of Israel, "Strike the ground with them." He struck three times and stopped. Then the man of God, Elisha, was angry with the king, and he said, "You should have struck five or six times. Then you would have struck down Aram until you had made an end of it. But now you will strike down Aram only three times." So it goes. So Elisha died, and they buried him, is the next line. Yeah. So, are wars won or lost over the number of times arrows strike the ground in some kind of pre-battle ritual? It seems a dubious claim at best, but so our story goes. And we also find forms of polytheism in the Hebrew Scriptures. Now, next week we're going to be talking about the rise of monotheism, one God who is above all the other gods. Since Judaism is a monotheistic religion, we don't think about polytheism being in the Bible, but it's there. One place, take a look at Genesis chapter 6, Genesis, of course, the first book of the Bible. Give us somebody a page number for Genesis 6. Page 5, that's easy. Now, this is a strange little passage, I'll warn you right now. It recalls a time when a bunch of male deities came down and had sex with attractive human females who bore children to them. Hey, don't blame me. It's in the Bible, folks. We begin reading chapter 6, verse 1. When people began to multiply on the face of the ground, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that they were fair, and they took wives for themselves of all that they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not abide in mortals forever, for they are flesh. Their days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went in to the daughters of humans, who bore children to them. These were the heroes that were of old, warriors of renown." We'll stop reading there. The Nephilim are a people that are mentioned twice in the Bible. The first time here, but in the book of Numbers, the Nephilim are these giant warriors. And when the Israelites first see them, they exclaim, "Ah, we look like grasshoppers next to them," they say. Genesis tells us the backstory of the Nephilim, where those big warriors came from. The Nephilim are so big and mighty because they are half God and half human. Their dads are gods. Gods are their dads, for real. A quick reminder here that we do not read these stories as literal or factual. These are myths. Progressive Christians do not believe, in this case, that gods came down from heaven and impregnated human women. Right? Right? Did y'all catch that? Okay. So, to recap, the story of God begins with nature, particularly the sun. And then, as people evolved, they sought to control their environment, as we all do. They assigned meaning to things that occurred, and as this happened, they began to create, began to be, to see gods or supernatural beings, many of them. If we're trying to understand how polytheism developed, we have to imagine how the world looked to people who lived many, many, many millennia ago. Not just before science, although that's true, but also before writing, before agriculture. Which means that we have to go back to the earliest humans that we know of. For perhaps 2 million years, humans were hunter-gatherers, nomadic people who lived in small groups, hunting and fishing and foraging for their food in the wild. And it would be great to know what hunter-gatherers thought, but guess what? There can be no detailed record of that because there was no writing. All we have is the stuff that archaeologists have found, tools and trinkets. We have some cave paintings here and there. It doesn't sound like much, but many smart anthropologists and other scientists have devoted their lives to such things. And I'm glad they did. And there are groups of nomadic people who live or have lived more recently than 12,000 years ago. And they live in much the same way, in isolation from the world. So anthropologists have sought them out and recorded their customs. All of these sources help us, as best we can, to reconstruct the spiritual landscape of prehistoric times. So we know of at least 5 different kinds of supernatural beings that the earliest people thought about. I'm going to go through them very quickly. 1, there were objects of nature. For example, when the clouds obscured the moon, it could be that the south wind was trying to kill the moon. Or in an eclipse, when the moon moved in front of the sun, it could be that the moon was trying to kill the sun. So, for example, these noise-making rituals developed to get the sun's attention, to warn it that the moon was coming. Think of it sort of like a soap opera played out in the sky. 2, puppeteers. The idea that parts of nature are controlled by mythical beings. There's a story handed down from the Klamath people who lived in what is now Oregon, modern-day Oregon. By their reckoning, the west wind came from a dwarf woman about 30 inches tall who literally passed gas. That was the source of the west wind. They had a very elaborate backstory for her. She wore a buckskin dress and a basket hat. They knew that because her image could be seen on a nearby mountain to the west. I mean, can't you imagine being a hunter-gatherer and kind of hanging out with the other hunter-gatherers, looking up at the mountains and trying to figure out where the wind came from when you felt it? 3, some thought that animals might have supernatural powers. There was one species of bird that was thought to make snow, another brought fog. Some animal spirits were thought to cure disease. And 4, there were ancestral spirits, people who had died but were still thought to be of influence in some way. The ancestral spirits, by the way, typically could do as much bad if they were not happy as good if they were. And 5, there were high gods. This is sort of a bridge to monotheism, which will come later. It's not that the high god controlled all the other gods. It was just a vague sense that the high god was the most important one. And usually it was connected to the sun in some way. But to ancient people, the involvement of gods explained the mystery of how nature worked. When someone gets sick today, we look to identify the germ that caused it. To them, a fitting response to illness was to figure out which god caused it. And also, hunter-gatherers wanted to know why bad things happen. And if the Mbutu pygmies of Africa's Congo region, for example, could not find animals to kill and eat, well, that meant that forest spirits who were avid hunters had gotten there first. When a bushman in the Kalahari Desert gets sick, chalk it up to the ancestral spirits who were not happy with him. Now, one difference between modern and primal religion, and I'm speaking in very general terms here, of course, one difference is that the hunter-gatherers did not really worship their gods. They treated them just like you treat a human being, kindly on some days and not as kindly on others. Aborigines in Japan, for example, would try to win divine favor by offering the gods beer. And if the gods did not reciprocate with good fortune, then they'd threaten to withhold future beer unless things improved. That one actually might work. Another aspect of hunter-gatherer religion is very significant and interesting to me, at least. Primal religion did not function in the realm of morality or ethics. Primal religion does not say, love one another. They didn't really care about that. They didn't think of the afterlife as reward or punishment. There was no moral scorecard, no notion of karma, no sense of you get what you deserve by how you live your life. There probably was some kind of afterlife, an eternal home after you die, but everybody was there, although some levels were better than others, and where you wound up was more likely to be based on how you died rather than how you lived. For example, Ottoman islanders believed that if you drowned, you wound up underwater as a sea spirit. And another tribe that thought that if you died by drowning, you'd become a killer whale. Primal religions were not concerned with ethical or moral implications for how to live. And that makes a lot of sense if you think about it, because hunter-gatherers live as everyone lived 12,000 years ago, in intimate groups. A village might consist of 30 or 40 people. That's all the people that you would encounter in your entire life, from birth to death, 30 or 40 of the same people. And if you live in a group of 30 or 40 people who are intimately familiar with each other, so many kinds of wrongdoing are, frankly, just hard to get away with. I mean, if you stole somebody's digging stick, where are you going to hide it? And what would be the point of having it if you could never use it? In other words, the fact that you have to live with these people for the rest of your life is by itself a pretty strong incentive to treat them well. If you want them to help you when you need help, then you sure better help them when they need help. And so, it is the reality of close community that in itself leads to ethical relationships. Religion was not the key to preserving social order. They just lived with the same 40 people their entire life. Of course, our reality is different in so many ways. We couldn't live in isolation if we tried. Sure, you might choose to go off by yourself and live somewhere, but from the time of birth, you're aware of a world with many, many people who come and go out of your life. We encounter countless people in a lifetime, and so anybody can steal a purse and hop the bus out of town if they choose to. If we fail to provide shelter to a starving refugee, we can just send them away and never see them again. We can lock up a drug addict and throw away the key. We can live in such a way that we never encounter homeless people on the streets. We can usually escape the implications for our actions. We often don't have to confront the very real pain that our actions might cause another. And so, in modern reality, religion has arisen as an ethical force. The golden rule, "Do unto others as you want done to you," becomes a helpful imperative if you want to create a just and loving world. For progressive Christians, there is no higher ideal than this notion of universal love. It's a gift of mainstream religions. Primal religions were completely devoid of that idea. It simply was not needed. Many of us are painfully aware of the failure of mainstream religions, including our own. One of the most significant contributions of modern religion is that every one of them has some version of the golden rule. Love for all is an ideal that is present in Christianity, in Islam, in Judaism, in Buddhism, and on and on and on. All mainstream religions instruct us to love for the sake of love, without discrimination. It's true, we don't always live up to it, but at least we realize we should, and that in and of itself is progress.